So sort of fast-forwarding to the present, at this point, what do we understand about the pathophysiology of this entity?
Well, the pathophysiology is directly related to the dose and the time of exposure of any bisphosphonate, including some of the oral bisphosphonates. Now, the IV bisphosphonates, Ometa and Aridia, are absorbed directly into the mineral matrix of bone, and they inhibit the enzyme farnesyl synthetase, which is required by the osteoclast for basic survival. So it all has to do with osteoclast downregulation and apoptosis.
And how does that lead to this entity? And when was the actual term osteonecrosis of the jaw coined, and who coined it?
It probably was me coining it, and it was coined initially in early 2004. The first reports, we thought it was an avascular necrosis. And when we started getting information about the action of the bisphosphonates, we knew it was due to the osteoclast downregulation. So it became an osteonecrosis in early 2004.
And can you talk a little bit more about exactly what's going on inside the bone and how that translates into the clinical presentation?
Yeah, I mean, that is easy. One of the things I think the medical oncologists need to know from this is that the other bones are not so severely affected. What is unique about the mandible and maxilla is the presence of teeth or the wearing of dentures. Good studies have shown that the bone in the tooth-bearing areas of the jaws that we call the alveolar bone remodels 10 times faster than any other adult bone. So therefore, there's a 10 times greater vulnerability of the bone around the teeth. Then you add to it the ubiquitousness of dental disease like decay and gum disease, and we call periodontal disease, and you add increased inflammation, increase the turnover even more. So if you have a drug like Zometa and Aridia that affect the osteoclast, which is involved with bone turnover, the bone cannot turn over. Osteocytes live essentially for 150 to 180 days. They die literally of a terminal lifespan, and they're not renewed and replaced. And so the osteoclast, when it resorbs bone, we know releases insulin-like growth factors 1 and 2 and bone morphogenetic protein. This, in turn, stimulates and causes a differentiation of stem cells into osteoblasts, and you reform your bone.
So I guess I must have studied this in med school, but I can't quite remember it. You're saying that the osteoclasts lead to osteoblast formation?
Oh, yes, yes. When an osteoblast forms bone initially, it imparts into the mineral matrix of bone, bone morphogenic proteins, and insulin-like growth factors 1 and 2. Now, these are acid-insoluble peptides. So when an osteoclast comes along and resorbs bone in a normal physiologic fashion, it recognizes the bone by certain chemical signals of bone either dying or being dead in the first place. So an osteoclast resorbs bone with hydrochloric acid within the Howship's lacunae. It releases the BMP. The BMP and insulin-like growth factors then attach to the cell membranes of stem cells that are in the local area. They're converted into osteoblasts, and the bone renews itself.
Are you saying it sort of has a garbage pickup type feature? It's sort of clearing it out?
It's a feedback loop type of a thing. In fact, the reformation of bone, like I said, occurs in normal adults about every 150 to 180 days. It's called a sigma in bone physiologic terms. So you interrupt this renewal cycle, and you end up with bone that outlives its lifespan, ends up dying off. The blood vessels involute because the osteocytes are dead, the osteoblasts are dead, and you get bone that becomes exposed.
There's a mucosa. What happens to that that covers it?
Well, the overlying mucosa, or gum tissue as often called, its blood supply is dependent on the underlying bone. So when the bone dies off, the overlying mucosa essentially also undergoes a necrosis. The bone becomes exposed.
Now, what sort of dental histories did these patients have or problems that they have? Was that directly correlated with where it occurs?
The answer there is yes and no. The most common place is the lower jaw in the back part, the molar area. And that has to do with the bite force characteristics. When everybody bites down on either food or during your swallowing process, you put pressure on your teeth. The greatest pressure is in the lower jaw in the molar area. And this is what makes the jaw vulnerable to anything that affects the osteoclast, from intravenous bisphosphonates to even oral bisphosphonates, in that the bone has to adjust to this bite pressure. So it resorbs and renews itself on a more rapid basis to accommodate the pressure forces of the chewing cycle and the swallowing cycle and all the pressures we put on it day to day.
So it doesn't have to have any pathophysiologic problem in terms of a dental problem. It just can be normal biting?
Yes. In fact, about 30% occur spontaneously in people who do not have an underlying dental pathogenesis. Now, the other side of that coin, obviously, is that people who do have inflammation from dental decay, from abscessed teeth, from gum disease called periodontal disease, increases the rate of bone turnover. And therefore, you get a higher percentage of people developing bone exposures who have those underlying dental problems.